Well, we are now in between two major holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, and for a lot of people, one or both of them involves getting together with family. Now, you may not even celebrate those holidays or both of them. There may be another day that's an important day for you that also involves getting together with family. And when you start talking with people about their experiences, you begin to find that that's not always easy. In fact, a lot of people will say getting together with family on occasions like that, it's not something that they enjoy, it's something they do because they feel that they have to. If you would include yourself in this group, this morning in this hour of the show, we may have some advice on making those experiences a little bit easier and perhaps more pleasant and perhaps better all around. Our guest for the program is Dr. Leonard Felder. He is a psychologist. He's authored a book which deals with this very subject. It's titled When Difficult Relatives Happen to Good People, the subtitle Surviving Your Family and Keeping Your Sanity. It's published by the Rodale Press. He is a recognized national expert on improving difficult family situations. His books have sold more than 1 million copies and have been translated into 14 languages. He also does a lot of speaking on this very subject. He's appeared on Oprah, on CNN, on CBS, on National Public Radio. He makes his home in Los Angeles. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions, comments are welcome. We just ask people our brief so that we can keep the program moving, but anyone's welcome to call here in Champaign, Urbana, the number 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WYLL or 9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Felder, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, and thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. Something I think that would be good to deal with right up front is the notion, the mistaken notion that many people have that if they have difficult times with their relatives, that somehow they're the only ones or that this is somehow an exception and that everyone else is having a great time. And in their house, it's the only place that things aren't going well. And you, in fact, were interested in testing that very hypothesis. And you did a survey, you did a study, you went out and talked with something like 1,400 people.
Right.
And first of all, asked them, do on holidays, special occasions, birthdays, so forth, do you get together with family? And a lot of them said, yeah. Then you went on to ask them, how would you describe these events? Would you say that they were enjoyable or not? And an awful lot of people said, no, we're really not having a very good time.
Yeah, you hit it on a good point, which is most people think, okay, this is our family secret. Ours is the only family where there's a drinking problem or where people are chronic advice givers or where they're always in your face trying to tell you how to run your life. And it's not just your family. It's the millions of families. And I found that 70% of families have these stressful interactions. You know, and there's still enough good moments that we come back year after year, but how can we somehow improve these family get-togethers? Because each one of our families has these tense, very, very uncomfortable moments where they're not accepting people for who they are, but who they think they ought to be.
Why do you think it is that a lot of people have this idea that other families are getting along great and it's Norman Rockwell over next door, when in fact, in so many other places, there's conflict? I mean, why is it that people think their family somehow is the only one that has the problems?
Well, if you turn on the television any time between November 15th and December 31st, about every 10 seconds, you see an ad for a wonderful family gathering. It's a Hallmark ad. It's a wine ad. It's a beer ad. It's some ad that says, you know, everybody's getting together, and they're clinking glasses, and they're smiling, and they're well-dressed, and they're well-behaved. And people say, well, how come my family doesn't look like that? And then if you watch the Christmas specials and if you watch the TV shows, every TV show's got some beautiful, heartwarming reconciliation where everybody starts to get along for the first time ever. And you say, well, how come at my family there's all this underlying elephant in the room and no one's talking about it?
Yeah, I think that indeed you put your finger on it, a mighty serious issue. These kinds of get-togethers are so fraught, they're so loaded with expectation, and popular culture lays that on top of us. And I suppose then if you lay on top of that the fact that it may be that in a lot of families there aren't, because now families are so spread out, there may also be not that many times when this can happen. So it seems that we're loading on top of these gatherings an awful lot of stuff, and that just makes it that much more difficult.
Right, and your point of the pressure that people say, okay, this is our one big chance to connect, to see each other, to fix each other, to change each other, that's a lot of pressure. Every spiritual and religious tradition and every sense of etiquette teaches you that you don't confront someone when there's 12 people watching the conversation,
yeah,
or where there's 20 people. You don't say, hey, when are you getting married, in front of somebody who, that's going to be a real hurtful comment to them. And yet our family members think this is the moment where they've got this one chance, and they've built up all this expectation that the holidays can be their one chance to turn you into the person they wish you always were, but you're never going to be because you're different from them.
Yeah. I think, too, there's this curious way in which, and that's not to say this can't be changed, but I think there's this curious way in which family dynamics are set pretty early in family history. And for that reason, for example, siblings, it seems that it doesn't matter how old they are, they could be 70, but they're still playing like they were 10. And in the same respect, I think it does not matter how old you are, you're always going to be the child of your parent. So if you're 70 and they're 90, it doesn't make any difference. That there's going to be some way in which that relationship, parent and child, is always going to be in effect. And it seems that both of those, you know, those programs continue to play, and they can play for a long time, no matter how old people are, even if they're to the point where they might say to themselves, and maybe even say to each other, you know, I think we're too old for this now.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't really seem to matter.
Yeah, but it's still hard to break an old habit. I mean, my older sister, I'm from Michigan, and my older sister is always going to be my older sister. And sometimes we can break through that and just be friends and just be equals. And sometimes she just feels that it's her job to be the advice giver or to try to bring everybody up in speed with, you know, following the family program.
In the very beginning, you say a couple of things that I certainly think are true. That in this chapter, the chapter one, the title of the chapter is "Why Do Certain Relatives Upset You at Such a Deep Level?" And there are two things that I think are fairly profound. Maybe the second even more profound than the first. The first one is that you know, it might be that something about them just embarrasses us.
Right.
And that seems sort of sad that we cannot accept them for what they are completely, but that it is the case. And again, as you say, that there are times when you look at that person, your blood relative, and say to yourself, "Am I related to this person?"
Yeah, and it's sad because, you know, we fear that this person's a reflection on us. And if you're a very kind and considerate person, and you've got a rude relative, or if you're a very devoutly religious person and someone in your family is very atheistic, or even the reverse, if you're an atheistic person and someone's devoutly religious, you think that onlookers are going to think that you have the same beliefs as this person or the same behaviors as this person. But most people can discriminate and say, yeah, you're your own person. You don't have to be identical to your family. And if one of your family members has some strange behaviors or some bad habits, it's not a reflection on you. And yet, somewhere in our shame feelings, we get caught in this web where we think we have to change our relatives in order to be safe in the world, in order to be able to show our face in public. And that's not true. A lot of times people could just accept and appreciate their relatives for all their complexity if they were a little less ashamed of what others might think.
Yeah. The other part of this that I think is may even be stronger but harder to see in oneself is that we may find it difficult sometimes being with relatives, not because we think their behavior will reflect badly on us. It's because we think they actually are us. They reflect us. That is, when we see in them something that a characteristic we share, and it wouldn't be surprising with people who are related and grew up together, some characteristic that we share, in fact, that we might not like very much. So what we're doing there is in seeing in them something in us that we really don't like.
Now, there you're getting deep, and a lot of people aren't that aware to be able to get in touch with that, but I think you're making a great point, which is if someone has maybe even a stronger version of some trait that you have a lighter version of, and you don't like seeing it yourself, and now you're seeing a stronger version of it in the other person, you know, it's really uncomfortable. And sometimes, I always urge people, I say, see these family members as your opportunities for growth. They are the irritations that are going to turn you into a pearl in that oyster of yours. If you can start to say, okay, what do I want to be, and what are the principles and the values and the decency I want to bring into my life, and what are the gifts I want to share? And when you look around at your family members, instead of judging them and trying to change them, say to yourself, what can I learn about how I want to behave based on what I'm seeing with my family? In 12-step programs, the expression is, don't take someone else's inventory, work on your own issues.
Let me introduce again our guest, Dr. Leonard Felder. He is the author of the book, When Difficult Relatives Happen to Good People, Surviving Your Family and Keeping Your Sanity. It's published by Rodale. It's relatively new. He is recognized national expert on improving difficult family situations. If you have questions, you can call us 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. There's a really interesting notion here about personality traits in families. And it's certainly true, people who are related by blood, and you don't even have to be related by blood, I guess, if you grew up together, you know that there are going to be a lot of similarities. And you look at families, they look alike, and they often act alike, and sometimes they think alike, and, that's not really surprising. But at the same time, though, with all the kind of similarities that can exist in families between parents and children and between siblings, there are going to be important differences. And parents will say that there was some aspect of their child's personality that they could see in that child virtually from the time he or she was born. So people, there are going to be important ways in which people are different, no matter how alike they are. And you introduce this interesting notion that somehow that may be almost on purpose, that in family groupings, there are going to be a range of personality traits, and that, some people will be more extroverted and some people will be more introverted, and they're just going to be those differences, and it may indeed be the case that they're there on purpose.
Right, whether it's God or nature or genetics or whatever it is, there is diversity within families. It's fascinating how someone in the family might have gotten a strong depression gene, and someone got a mild depression gene, which made them artistic and creative and empathic and sensitive, but they don't struggle with the deep depression that other person does, and then someone else got none of the depression gene, and they're kind of a boring person. They don't appreciate some of the depths and some of the dark nights of the soul. So in every family, you're going to see that full range. Or I also point out in the first chapter about the narcissist that there might be someone in the family who was given lots of self-absorption and desire to always have his way or her way, and there's someone else in the family who's the family doormat who's always trying to take care of others and does it too much. And then there might be someone in the middle who's got a good balance of trying to honor your own gifts and also being very respectful and helpful to others. In every family, there's going to be this diversity. You have to be in awe of the mystery of the universe that creates this diversity, even within families where they look alike, they have the same eye color, they have the same way of walking and talking, and yet there's this huge range in personality factor.
And a little bit ago, we were talking about these two sorts of things that somehow sometimes might make family relations difficult. That is, if you have some relative that you find difficult to be around, there could be these two major reasons, either because you find them embarrassing, you think they reflect badly on you and your family. The other part is that you maybe, in fact, think down deep they reflect you. There's something in...
Right. If you struggle with anger and someone in your family doesn't do as good a job as you do on dealing with their anger, it's going to be hard to be around them. Where if you're a little bit controlling and obsessive and want everything just right, and then you see someone in the family who's 20% worse on that issue than you are, it's painful to see that stronger version of the thing you've been wrestling with in your own life.
So the question now is, what do you do about this? And you make some suggestions here at this point of trying, if you can, to detach, to step back a little bit, almost indeed to the point where you look at that person and say, I wonder who could this strange person possibly be? It goes back to this question, am I related to this person? That's, in a sense, using
humor. Yeah,
to bring
that into the sense of humor. Yeah. I mean, if you can get your sense of humor back, and if you can say, okay, imagine myself to be a virgin anthropologist from Mars observing this family for the first time, have some fun with it, because if you get your sense of humor back, you're not going to feel 12 years old or 7 years old and powerless again. You're going to feel like an adult. You're going to feel like someone who can say, these are interesting characters. What a piece of work this is.
What about that? The other part, though, that seems a little bit more difficult, that is that aspect when, in fact, maybe the reason that this relative upsets you is that you recognize that some of what bothers you about them, those are traits, actually, that you have.
And that can be a very positive moment where you say to yourself, okay, I can see how unattractive that trait is when I see it in one of my family members. I'm really going to do some work this year to make sure I don't keep being that way. So if you notice that someone in your family is impatient and judgmental and critical, or they're really mean to their kids, and it makes you say, you know what, I'm going to make so much more of an effort this year to not be that way, because this has helped me see exactly what that looks like. I know that in my family is very uptight about time, my family in Michigan. And my wife, who's from California, she's very loose about time. And she takes us on detours, and she explores things in the moment, and she shows me a life that I wouldn't be able to see, because when you're uptight about time, you're always on your agenda, and you don't really get to see the spontaneous moments. So when I'm around my family, I see their rigidity about time, and I say, you know what, I am so grateful that I've been able to be on time for things and also to be able to be flexible and have someone in my life, my wife, who can teach me how to be more spontaneous, more in the moment, more willing to take detours.
Those coping strategies are a little bit sort of in the category of accepting things, trying to accept things the way that they are. The other thing that people might feel drawn to do is actually try to change things.
Right.
And you say again here, maybe it's best first to acknowledge things that people do that are counterproductive before talking about what it is good to do. And that seems like perhaps the major things that people do is either they just explode. They really let somebody have it. They give them the proverbial piece of their mind, or they do the opposite. And that is they bottle it up inside. And of course, the problem with that approach is that eventually it's going to find a way to get out anyway. But what are the two problems that are associated with either telling the person, let me tell you right now what I think, either that or just seething and inside saying, this is what I really feel, but not voicing that.
Yeah, I mean, if you unload on somebody, you're going to provoke their defensiveness. They're going to tune you out. It's an ineffective way of getting change. Or if you just clam up and you just say nothing and then you try to keep it inside, you'll eventually explode, or you'll eventually pull away from that person or the family. So those are the two extremes that don't work. And what's in the middle is something I call the caring sandwich. And that's where you say something positive and true about the person. That's the top layer of the sandwich. And then the middle layer is where you say something about their specific behavior, but you're still honoring who they are as a human being. And if you can really honor who someone is as a human being and point out just a small, slight change that you're hoping for in this particular behavior, and then the bottom is to also, honor who they are. I had to do this with my dad and my stepmom. They live in Florida now. And when I would bring my hyperactive 10-year-old son to visit them, they would say, fingers, fingers, fingers. Why are you touching them? Finger, fingers, fingers. Drove him crazy. So I decided, okay, I'm going to have to use the advice in my book here. And I sat them down, and I said, we have to talk about. I said, you guys love Stevie, and Stevie loves you. That was the positive part of the sandwich. Here comes the middle part with the behavior. I said, when you say to him, fingers, 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 he's going to get the impression that you don't love him, which we don't want. You don't want that. So let's work together as a team. What are the objects he shouldn't touch? What are the objects he can touch and explore? He's a tactile learner. He needs to touch things. So they got defensive at first, and they said, oh, we would never say that, and you're such a touchy-feely psychologist, and all those things. But that means they heard me. A lot of times when people are resisting you or defending themselves, it means they did hear what you had to say. And they changed their behavior by about 70%. The fingers, fingers, fingers went down 70%, which I thought was a huge improvement. And I don't need them to be perfect, but I do need them to make a slight improvement in their behavior. Even though they're still controlling people, they've made a slight change in their behavior. So again, don't try to change someone's basic personality, but see if they're willing to make a little bit of a shift on one small behavior.
Mm-hmm. It seems that at its base, when you're advising people on improving their relations with people close to them, could be spouses, could be parents, could be parent and child, basic sort of bedrock starting point is saying that before you get to the crisis, you have to think about how it is we manage that crisis and perhaps doing something differently than the way that we have done it. And it seems that in all of these situations, that is the challenge. You actually have to think about what you're going to do before you get there.
That's a great point. And I urge people in the book to imagine themselves to be like a customer service representative. If you imagine yourself to be a rebellious teenager, you're going to come out with all sorts of stuff that's going to provoke World War III in your family. On the other hand, if you think of yourself as a customer service person, you can say, okay, I can hear people's irritations, and I can listen, I can take them seriously, and the customer service person knows that's how you diffuse someone's anger. That's how you get them to be your ally. That's how you get them to calm down, is by taking them seriously and saying, okay, let me understand what you're upset about, and let's work together to see what kind of a solution we can come up with. Let's brainstorm together and see how we can improve this. Now you're acting like a manager instead of a trapped teenager who doesn't want to be there in the first place.
We're just about at our midpoint already in this part of Focus, and I just would like to introduce again our guest and invite people to call if you have questions or comments. We're speaking with Dr. Leonard Felder. He is a psychologist. He's a recognized national expert on improving difficult family situations. His books have sold more than 1 million copies and have been translated into a number of languages. He's does a lot of speaking. He's been interviewed quite a lot on television and on radio. And if you're interested in some help with this specific topic here we're talking about, you might look for his recent book, which is titled When Difficult Relatives Happen to Good People, Surviving Your Family and Keeping Your Sanity. That's the subtitle, and Rodale is the publisher. Here on the program, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. One of the on your website, you have this quiz that you can suggest to people, and asking questions like, is there someone in your family who sometimes gets on your nerves, and on and on. Here's one I found myself doing, and that is the one, have you ever found yourself arguing inside your head with someone before or after a family gathering? And I'm afraid I have to admit I've been there.
Which is real normal. Everybody who's got a good brain, you need to realize that the brain is a problem-seeking missile, and there's often been research in psychology that shows that brains seek to solve incomplete sentences, incomplete situations, incomplete relationships. That's what brains do. Brains do not go to gratitude or joy or relaxation too easily. You have to manually get the brain to go there. What the brain does automatically is it tries to work on what's incomplete. And if there's some incomplete, unfinished business with family members, your brain's going to work on that.
You, again, I guess I'm interested in offering people something, hoping something that they can come away with, ways to improve these kinds of situations. And as we are in this time here where a lot of folks are going to be getting together for holidays, whatever holidays people celebrate, and they're obviously all through the year, there are times when people get together. You offer in one particular chapter 5 ways to improve family get-togethers and holiday visits. And actually, I think I like the first one. That's another one that I think I'm going to try to apply to my life. And that is shorten the length of get-togethers. And that's not one people might think about. Or again, if you have one of these situations where people don't see each other very much during the year, they might think, well, this is our one opportunity, so we're going to spend as much time as we can. And that then actually that sort of enforced togetherness over a long period of time, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5 days a week, something like that even, turns out probably not to be a good idea.
Yeah, you have to assess what does work in this family. So, for instance, if a 2-hour visit for a big meal works and the 5-hour visit with the 3 hours of cocktails causes people to be over the top with their alcohol drinking and then they start to get cranky and sarcastic, you know, ask yourself, can we do the 2-hour version? Or if you know that you can do a day and a half with your family, and you get along great, and you do some fun things together, you enjoy catching up, and maybe you need to stay in a separate place, not under the same roof. What works? And sometimes you're going to have to break the family tradition to focus on what works. And I've had to do that with my family, where I say, let's do what tends to work, and let's not just do what hasn't worked in the past. I know that it's nice to stay with the same traditions and routines, but sometimes if we try a one-time experiment, this is what you can say to the person who's resisting the change. You can say, let's just try it as a one-time experiment, see how it goes. I want to hear your reactions to it, and then we'll decide what to do next.
Another thing that maybe for individuals might be a particular difficulty on these kinds of days is the traditions were ways of doing things or what particular people like to do. If maybe the majority of people have something that they want to do when they get together, whether that is, I suppose the stereotype would be watching sports on television or, as you say in the book, sitting around the table arguing about something, could right. be politics, could be social issues, could be, you know, who knows what, could be being in the kitchen and getting involved with cooking. It could be, you know, who knows, it could be throwing the football around. I mean, you know, whatever it is, what do you do if you're the odd person out that says, whatever that thing is, you say, well, that's just not my thing.
Yeah, you have to figure out what is something for you, but if you're willing to stretch a little bit, sometimes those intimate moments do take place when you're cutting vegetables in the kitchen or when you're clearing the table or when you're fixing something together or putting up something or taking something down or, you know, putting up the chairs, putting down the tables. Those are the moments where people are working as a team. That's where they're, you know, pitching in together. That's where they're maybe having some small conversations about how's it been since so-and-so died and how are you dealing with that medical diagnosis and do you miss so-and-so? And, you know, you can have those real conversations, whereas usually at the big family dinner table, there's one or two people who dominate. They usually argue about how they feel about President Bush, and it doesn't go too far, or people start to, you know, tell each other how to practice their religion. If you can find some way to have the intimate, close moments, then over the course of a lifetime, you realize, I have connected with my loved ones. I have found a way to be a member of this family. I've been a part of that team. It's different from just feeling shut down and invisible around the big family table.
We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let us do that in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about how, you know, if people overdo it on the family gathering too long, that, you know, kind of doesn't work as well as the short gathering.
Okay.
Well, you know, there's kind of a similar situation where which is also somewhat related to Christmas, the Christmas season, which is that, you know, way back in the olden days, when in the days of slavery, you know, the slaves were not allowed to drink or have alcohol at all, and of course they had to work very hard all year. But what the slave owners did on Christmas week was they gave the slaves a huge Saturnalia, and they would give for a whole week. They would just one solid week. They would give the slaves just as much whiskey and moonshine or whatever as they could possibly drink, and they would get so thoroughly sick of it that they didn't want any more for an entire year. And so I don't know. I just thought maybe if people, you know, if people think like out of some responsibility to their family, they have to, you know, overdo it because they haven't seen each other for so long. Maybe, I don't know. That's maybe I just thought maybe that was something to keep in mind.
That's a bit, you know, I didn't know that historical fact, and it is interesting. You know, the idea though of letting somebody have it out at Midsummer's Night's festival, you know, in Northern European cultures, or you're saying to really have burst it all out at the holidays. You know, if that works, and if it does work in your family, fine. What I find though in most families is that when people do drink, some people, they just get pleasant, and most people get kind of crabby, and they get kind of sarcastic, and they get kind of short-tempered, and stuff happens, and sometimes the inhibitions fall away, and some of the real negativity comes out. And it's sad, because those are the memories that a lot of people take away from the holidays, those moments when so-and-so really let you have it in a way that really hurt. And it's sad, because families, we need each other, we long to connect with each other, and yet those comments that sometimes alcohol brings about cause people to just really come away with bad feelings.
Yeah, I guess I'll just say one more thing, that there's another example is when people feel like, you know, they have to go on a vacation and they don't want to, or a lot of the people don't want to, and, you know, everybody's just dragging themselves, like the European vacation, you know, one country per day or whatever, and you know, months and years later they think, oh my gosh, wasn't that whole thing a pain? So anyway, maybe I guess the most, you know, if people enjoy their gatherings, and that's good, but I'll hang up, but I wanted to say that maybe that's the most important thing.
Right, yeah, then. I think if you can find a way to enjoy it, and you know what our host said before about planning ahead of time is so crucial. If you plan ahead of time, say, okay, we're going to spend 2 days or 4 days or 7 days with the family, what can we mix in so that we really have great memories from that visit? What are some of the things we can do with our family members that bring out the best in them? So, for instance, my dad can get kind of cranky when he's watching three football games on a Sunday, and that by the time of that third game and he's had too much to drink, you know, it's not a pleasant scene. On the other hand, sometimes if I've gotten him to take a walk, or I've gotten him to go to a museum, or I've gotten him to, you know, go out to a place where he'll tell some interesting stories about when he was first coming to this country, you know, those are the moments that I cherish. And just sitting and watching football with someone sometimes doesn't do it. So if you can figure out how to make something happen that'll make magic happen within your family, and if you can get one or two people to go along with that program and maybe build up a couple of allies who will help lobby ahead of time, that, okay, this year we're all going to go to that music event, or we're going to go to that cultural event, that's something that you'll come away with good memories from, instead of just feeling like, okay, we're trapped, we're claustrophobic with each other.
Mm. You know, I think that though that the caller says something that I think that is true, at least it's true in my experience, and I think that I see that a fair amount, and that is a disturbing tendency in holidays and their celebration for excess. And I don't just mean drinking. It could be the activities. It could be if gift giving is part of it, then that could be part of it. In all sorts of ways, maybe even in togetherness, it can be the same thing. And it seems that in all of those areas, that can be a problem, because then you lose sight of what the thing is supposed to be about, because it begins almost to be a kind of competitive exercise.
Yeah, you're making a great point. So, for instance, on gifts, there's some families who get creative and they break the tradition, and they say, this year, let's, you know, pick out of a hat. Each person's going to buy one gift for one person, and instead of having to buy 12 gifts for 12 people. You know, you really get a sense of, okay, let's be creative and constructive here. Let's not brutalize the people in the family who don't have money or who don't have time to do that much shopping. Or, for instance, with food, if you can be reasonable and say, okay, we're going to try to eat, you know, we're going to eat a nice, healthy amount of food. And some people say, no, you're supposed to gorge on 10,000 desserts. It's the holiday. But if someone says, okay, this year I'm going to make sure that I don't overeat, many people numb themselves out with the alcohol and the gift-giving and the food, so that they don't have to really feel the discomfort that they're feeling. And then they come away with colds, flus, and all sorts of stuff after the holidays. If you want to be the first healthy member of your family might try to resist you. They might say, oh, you're a stick in the mud. But on the other hand, you might come away from the holiday with the good memories and without the over, you know, the headaches and the stomach aches and all the stuff that a lot of people come away with.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone in Champaign next on line two. Hello.
Hi. Well, this is just such a great topic. I wanted to tackle a couple of things. One is the whole drinking question. My family has kind of a history with this, and I think one of the things that if you have that in your family is don't carry it past the holiday. Recognize that whatever bad behavior happens, it's because of the drinking, and, you know, that's not a good thing for long term, of course, but on the other hand, it's also because of the drinking, so just let it go. And sometimes the problem is we hold people accountable, even though we know that this is part of their behavior pattern, even though we know that this is a long-term issue for them, and it may be quite unhealthy. But on the other hand, why hold people, you know, to standards that they're obviously not willing to live up to? And sometimes just letting that go and just writing it off as, yep, that's just them. They drink too much.
So that's a good point. You know, in order to come away with some of the good memories and to remember the good moments, sometimes you do have to let go of some of the things, especially the things that were alcohol-induced, and that this person does have, whether you call it a disease or an addiction or a habit or whatever, and to say this person is more complex than just their drinking or just how they behave when they're drinking, I have to see the bigger picture. And I think you're making a good point there.
Well, and it's also, the question is, how much are you encouraging that? Just because you know you have this relative who drinks heavy, does that mean you have to drink heavy too? If you know somebody else has got a problem, maybe that's a sign for you to kind of back off for that particular holiday and not engage. And that's really my second big point. I think a lot of the holiday problems in families come because we're trying to change our family members. Mm-hmm. And whenever you try to change someone else, you're heading for a world of trouble. And I think that one of the best strategies is to just choose not to engage in whatever their behavior is. And one of the things that I found very helpful is just to you know, put a label on people. Now, usually we don't want to say put a label on people, but here's a time when maybe that's appropriate. So, you know, that's Grandma. She's a worrier. You know, that's my sister. She's the critic. That's my Uncle Bob. He likes to drink and talk about politics. And if I put that label on them, then when they get into those behaviors, I don't have to take it personally. I don't have to take it to heart. I don't have to feel it emotionally. I can just kind of let it ride off my back if I keep that kind of perspective.
This is good. So the perspective that you bring gives you some immune system for dealing with the holiday. And, you know, in a sense, you're able to navigate the hard moments because you come in prepared, knowing what to expect, not being shocked when it happens again.
Exactly.
Sometimes people act shocked when the same stuff happens that's happened 20 years in a row. And you're saying, if you come in knowing what to expect and knowing that you're going to shrug off some of the first few irritating things but not really be overwhelmed by them, you can enjoy the visit. You can take good care of yourself. And you can eat in moderation and drink in moderation or not drink at all. And I urge people, even be willing to put up with the teasing. I know that in my family, when I drink the club soda with lime, people tease. People make comments. When I eat the healthy food that keeps me healthy so I don't have to get sick, people make fun. I'm willing to live with that teasing rather than come away with the hangover.
Exactly. And you can enjoy your family for what they are. And, you know, everybody has good and bad parts. You can enjoy the good parts, write off the bad parts. Don't worry about it. It's not that important to get into it. And I think the big problem is sometimes people, you know, when you get pushed, the natural tendency is to push back. And I think that's the key right there. If you just choose not to push back, then you're going to be a lot happier and it's going to be a lot less stressful for you. You won't change their behavior necessarily, but then again, your good example just might. One other suggestion I would offer, and this is something I've used in my own family, is just set some ground rules. You know, here's a topic I'm not going to talk about.
Uh-huh.
And if the topic comes up, give everybody a warning. If you guys want to continue talking about this, I'm leaving the table. I'm leaving the room. I'm going to go out for a walk or whatever it is. And if they continue talking, do it.
Right. In your case, you've got the strength to be able to say that and articulate that. Now, in many families, people feel like they don't have the strength to say what you just said. If don't talk about that or I'll walk out. That's too explosive, but you know, you've got the self-esteem to do that. In the situation where people feel like they don't have the clout to do that, I urge you, find out who is the ally in your family who appreciates you, who accepts you, who loves you, and you can rally ahead of time with that ally and say, when they bring up my weight or my marital status or my this or my that, would you be willing to clink the glass like at a wedding and change the subject and say, okay, can we talk about what we're all struggling with and what we'd like to accomplish in this next year, or what we're grateful for this year, or what are our favorite memories of this holiday. Someone who has the clout to change the subject and no one talks back to that person.
Now, that's a very interesting one, too. I mentioned that, you know, the example I used before was my grandmother, the worrier. Well, that's what my grandmother was. And we kind of had an agreement with the rest of the family where if Grandma got into a worry thing, then if somebody else got caught up in that and started worrying, too,
uh-huh.
then somebody else would notice that, intercede, and kind of pull that person away. And then, you know, Grandma can continue worrying, but the other person wouldn't get all upset. And seeking allies is a really neat idea. Here's one other suggestion. My wife and I had a dinner club, you know, with several other couples, and one of the rules that we had was we had a little dinner bell. And if the conversation got into a topic that anyone objected to, then the standing rule was anybody who rings that bell, the conversation has to stop.
Wow.
Change subjects. Now, that was a group of adults who, you know,
who were willing to play by the rules.
Yeah, now, in a family situation, that would be a really weird conversation to say, let's try this. But your philosophy of suggesting it as an experiment might be a great way to introduce that into a family environment, not just a, you know, friends kind of situation.
Yeah, I mean, if your family's got Democrats and Republicans and they like to ruin the holiday by fighting with each other about who's right and who's wrong, it's not a who's right, who's wrong. The country apparently needs both Democrats and Republicans. And so, you know, we don't have to fight that out once and for all at the family gathering. And you might want to say, okay, when we get into the political fight, is there anybody who's willing to call time out or ring the bell or say, can we change to a subject that everybody can participate on as family instead of as adversaries?
You're giving some great ideas, and I'd love to hear some more of those practical solutions. So thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you for the call. We have about 10 minutes left. Let me introduce again our guest, Dr. Leonard Felder. He's a psychologist. He's the author of the book, When Difficult Relatives Happen to Good People, Surviving Your Family and Keeping Your Sanity. It's published by Rodale. He is a nationally recognized expert on improving difficult family situations and has written a lot about these sorts of issues and does a lot of talking on radio and television. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Chicago on our line number 4. Hello.
Hi, I just wanted to say that a lot of times what happens is in families is a matter of perception, and you have to be very careful because sometimes the thing that annoys you, someone else would die to be in your situation and be very grateful. And I think that what you need to always look at is, was the act done out of love or with malicious intent, and really try to discern between the two. Because if it was an act that was done out of the way that person shows love, if you react in anger, they're just going to continue to do it because they're trying to behave lovingly and to deflect your anger. And so you really need to somehow step back and see how to give them a loving response in order to change that behavior. And the other problem is that I think I've decided with my family that the day they change will be the day that I change. And so since I love some of my annoying habits, I have to respect their annoying habits. And I just have the attitude that I tell everyone I have the most wonderful family in the world, because how could they be anything else since they love me? And I just accept all of the problems with that because, as I said, if it's an act that's done out of love and not of malicious intent, there's a big difference.
Right, you're making a very interesting point, and this is a point that a lot of people resist, but I'm hoping listeners will take this seriously for at least a minute. When a family member says something that's advice that you don't want to hear, or criticism, or comments, or they lay a guilt trip on you, there's a fun exercise. I've taught for 20 years at UCLA Extension. I urge all the students to go out and try this exercise. And the exercise is, find the love that's deeply buried underneath that obnoxious remark.
Right.
Because there usually is. There's usually some sense that, you know, that even this person who's breathing down your neck and trying to tell you how to run your life, they think they're doing something loving. They do think that if you follow their way, it'll be a good thing for you. Now, if you're willing, you can take the love that's underneath all that nonsense. Ignore the nonsense. You don't have to take the advice. You've got your own set of advisors. You've got your own cabinet. You've got your own self. You've got your own spiritual and religious and philosophical teachings to read. You can find your own way of solving the same problem, but know that their advice or their comments or their criticism come from a place that they want you to be happy. They want there to be, you know, a loving moment happening between you. And they're doing it all wrong, but at least if you know they're coming from a loving place, it takes a lot of the sting out of it for you.
And that's so important because they're going to get pushier since it's out of love and they're really trying to make you better. If you react in anger and resist them, they're just going to be pushier because it's their goal to save you and help you. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, until you're able to find the love and respond lovingly to them, it won't stop.
So let me bring up a controversial point about this. A lot of times people who are secular or moderate in their religion are very offended when people who are very fundamentalist in their religion get in your face and start to tell you how to practice your life and how to get saved and all that. And what I urge people to do is don't try to turn this person into a moderate or secular person. It ain't going to happen. The old expression is you should live so long before they're going to change on this issue. What you can do instead is you can sit them down and say, tell me, when you talk about how I should do this and how I should do that, tell me what's the deep intent, and tell me what's that been like for you in your life when you followed that path. You can appreciate that they have a journey and a path that's different from yours, that for them makes perfect sense. And you can say, wow, this person really is saying that from a deeply loving place. And you don't have to accept the advice. You can say, I have an also equally valid way of living my life, of trying to find goodness in the world, of trying to make this a better world. And can we both live under the same family, you know, heading? Can we both live on the same planet? If people who are fundamentalists and people who are liberal or moderate can respect that both sides are trying to make the world better and that we totally disagree about how to do that, then we can actually dialogue with each other from a more constructive place. I've done dialogues in Los Angeles where people who totally agree about abortion can figure out where do we have points in common, what can we do to help teenage girls and teenage boys be more responsible. These are the places where we have things in common. Let's work together on those things, and let's stop fighting about the places where we totally disagree with each other.
thank you for this show, though. I think you're going to make a lot of people's Christmas holiday a lot happier.
All right. Well, thank you. Well, if that's true, then we've done a good thing. Let me say one other, mention one other thing that also is in your chapter about five things that you can do to make things better, which may be difficult because of the time pressures that people are under. And it seems when they're going to be with a family, they're rushed and harried. And when they're leaving, they're rushed and harried. But you do suggest, particularly if you know or if you suspect that it's going to be difficult, that what you need to try to do is establish some calm before and then give yourself some time after to relax. And that maybe doing those two things also, if things are going to be difficult or if you know they're going to be difficult, doing those two things will help.
Yeah, if you go right up to December 25th and you're buying and shopping and dealing with traffic and lines and all that stuff, you're probably going to stress yourself out, be right on the edge of bronchitis or whatever with a short temper by the time you walk in the door. That's not the best way to walk in. So I urge people, schedule, whether it's a half a day or a whole day or an hour is the best you can do, schedule a mental health hour or half a day where you say, this is something I really love doing. I love doing yoga or exercising or reading a spiritual book or listening to music or talking to a best friend, something that's nurturing to you that says, I'm going to walk into this next family gathering not from a burned-out place, but from a place of saying, I like my life. I like, you know, the changes and the developments that I've been doing with my life. I'm going to try to walk in as a healthy person rather than a stressed-out person.
Well, I hope that we have given some people a few things to think about, and if you would like to pursue this further, you should look for the book that we have mentioned. It's titled When Difficult Relatives Happen to Good People by our guest, Dr. Leonard Felder.
It might be hard to find. Bookstores, when they sell it, they don't reorder, so Amazon's got it. BarnesandNoble.com has it, and you can always ask your bookstore to order it. They can get it for you in a couple days.
Absolutely, published by Rodale. Well, Dr. Felder, thanks very much.
Oh, thank you. Good luck to you and your family.
All right, thank you.